Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, a lot of people are waiting for new kidneys, but in several cases, those donated from deceased individuals are discarded because they're no longer viable. We'll hear about a procedure that rehabilitates the organs and can save lives. The ability to clearly see stars in the night skies is being lost due to light pollution, but some communities are finding ways to change that, and it can benefit humans and wildlife. A longtime fall tourist attraction in central Illinois planning for its final season. We'll talk with a first-generation college student as she prepares for classes. The incarcerated often have difficulty once they're released, but a tattoo removal program at one state prison may help some get a fresh start. And we hear from some former high schoolers who missed out on their prom due to COVID. They made up for it this summer. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. More than 100,000 people in the U.S. are on a years-long wait list for a kidney transplant. Thousands of deceased donor kidneys last year were discarded. Side Effects Public Media's Elizabeth Gabriel reports on one organization in Indiana trying to revive those discarded kidneys to serve more patients.
Most kidney donations come from people who are recently deceased. Once a kidney is removed from the body, it's placed on ice in a styrofoam cooler and transported to where it's needed. That's when the clock starts ticking. The longer the organ is outside the body, the higher the chances of things going wrong. Transplant surgeons can get a small biopsy of the organ, run imaging, and collect medical information from the donor. But that isn't always enough information, says Leonardo Riella. He is a transplant nephrologist with the Massachusetts General Hospital.
These biopsies are processed very quickly, meaning we cannot do all the stains to look at all the different aspects of the kidney. So we may not be able to actually say what's going on with the rest of the kidney because sometimes things can be spotty in terms of how they affect the kidney.
It makes the surgeon's jobs that much harder. And if the kidney has been outside the body for too long, or the surgeons aren't certain it would work efficiently once transplanted, they decline it. It's partly why over 9,000 donated kidneys were discarded last year. That's what 34 Lives hopes to change. It's a company housed at Purdue University's Research Park in West Lafayette, Indiana. They're leading an observational study to preserve kidneys instead of discarding them.
Every kidney transplanted into a patient saves Medicare about $2.5 million.
That's Chris Janes, the co-CEO of 34 Lives. Janes says a typical kidney can't stay outside the body for more than 24 to 36 hours, but the organization works to extend that time frame. 34 Lives places the kidney on a little life support machine.
That allows us to warm it back up to body temperature. We almost trick it into thinking it's still inside a body, and it can start working and functioning just like it was inside a body still.
They provide each kidney with nutrients to let it heal itself. They also run nearly 3 dozen tests to determine how well it works. That allows transplant surgeons to make more informed decisions and help more patients. Indianapolis resident Sylvia Miles was diagnosed with lupus, a chronic autoimmune disease that causes the body's immune system to attack healthy tissue, including her kidney. Miles was on dialysis. She often experienced severe pain. Her muscles would tense up, sometimes making her unable to move or work. Everything changed when Miles received a kidney last year that was saved by 34 Lives.
I tell you, I feel amazing. I haven't had a flare-up since I had a transplant, which is a great deal for me.
The company received a $44 million award last year to support their study from the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, a federal investment agency. Dr. Renee Wagerson was the head of the agency before the Trump administration let her go in February. Side Effects talked to her before she was let go. She said the research could shorten how long people stay on the kidney transplant list. Right now, the average wait is 5 years, and many people die waiting.
Imagine a future where we didn't have to do dialysis at all because we had enough kidneys for everybody, and we can turn around somebody in crisis who needs a kidney, in days to weeks.
Still, reducing the kidney discard rate will only help a fraction of people who need a new kidney. Dr. Riella at Mass General says the issue needs to be addressed in two other ways.
One is reducing barrier for living donations so that, you know, there are more living donors around. And then, of course, is the xenotransplantation. So looking for organs from other species that have been genetically modified to try to close the gap.
But it could still be years before scientific research can lead to enough kidneys for every patient. Elizabeth Gabriel, Side Effects Public Media.
A study published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences suggests teenage brains are maturing faster than usual. It's a side effect of the COVID-19 pandemic. Lauren Warnicki has more.
Researchers looked at the cerebral cortices of teens before and after the pandemic. They found differences in the 4-millimeter outer layer of the brain responsible for memory, reasoning, and problem solving. They found accelerated thinning equated to about 4 years of extra aging in girls. That's compared to just over 1 year in teenage boys.
These findings are kind of startling if you just look at the headline.
That's clinical psychologist Kyle Berkey. He's the director of behavioral sciences at OSF in Bloomington. Berkey noted the study's limitations, including a small sample size.
But I think it's a great conversation point that we're starting to look at what the true impact of the pandemic was. But I think from my perspective, more important than figuring out what has occurred is that we start to think about what we need to do in the future instead.
According to Berkey, the COVID-19 virus is not the root cause of this advanced maturation of the brain. It was the lack of social activity. The areas of the brain most affected deal with processing of emotions, empathy, and language centers. Teens' relative fluency with social media and online communication provided alternative sources of interaction during the pandemic when face-to-face conversations were not an option. But Berkey says teens have not returned to pre-pandemic socialization.
When I'm relying upon two-dimensional social interactions where I'm not picking up as much on a three-dimensional, you know, facial cues and all of that, I think that's where we're seeing some of this, you know, come from.
Teens likely aren't the only age group impacted by social gaps during the pandemic, but it is a particularly important time for brain development. In addition to physical maturation during puberty, teenagers experience rapid social emotional growth as they shift their primary social interactions from their parents to their peers. Berkey says brain development during adolescence is, quote, already a very complicated place, and that's before a world-shifting pandemic.
Not to mention, you know, stress. We know that cortical thinning comes a lot from stress. And all of us, whether we are adolescents or adults, we were all under a lot of stress during, you know, the peak of the pandemic.
Berkey cautions against jumping to the conclusion that teens are experiencing negative outcomes due to cortical thinning. He says these are not problems so much as they are observations. And it invites a conversation around social media's role in teens' social lives.
I think the role is to help facilitate in-person interactions. And unfortunately, it's moved to where the social media is the social interaction. And that's really what we need to be cognizant of. Use it to find others, link up with people who have similar interests, and be able to then get those in-person social interactions because of using the tool.
Perhaps the biggest takeaway from the study is the gender gap. With teen girls' brains affected 4 times that of boys, Berkey notes the extra importance of face-to-face interactions for girls.
Females have a tendency to be more one-on-one and communicative, where a typical male might be totally content to just sit there and watch TV next to their friend and think it was a great social interaction.
Recent data also shows girls may be more negatively impacted by social media. In 2021, a former Facebook employee leaked documents showing teen girls experience worsened body image and increased eating disorders after using Instagram, in part because the algorithm has been tuned to feed teens with unrealistic images and advertisements promoting dieting. The Mayo Clinic suggests parents set realistic boundaries on social media, such as limiting devices at the dinner table or in bed, and discussing positive ways to use social media.
Lauren Warnicki with that report, with help from Colleen Holden. With the school year kicking off across Illinois, some districts are having students go about their day without their cell phones. In East Central Illinois, school started back up in Windsor and Martinsville last week. Students there have to lock their phones away during the school day. Kyle Thompson is the regional superintendent. He's been pushing the idea as a way to improve student behavior, mental health, and academic performance.
I don't know if it's up to 14 or 18 states or something now that have banned cell phones entirely in schools. So it's a statewide ban. And that's red and blue states. So it's agreed upon on both sides of the aisle, which is rare.
Thompson says he'd prefer to see districts restrict student cell phone access on their own without new regulations. The Democratic governor, J.B. Pritzker, promoted a bill this spring that would require districts to ban phones during class time. Thompson says most districts already have that policy. He thinks locking phones away for the whole day is more effective. Americans are losing their starry views to light pollution, but communities can make lighting decisions to help preserve night skies while benefiting wildlife and human health. Harvest Public Media contributor Celia Yopis-Jepson reports.
Outside Kirksville, Missouri, there's a state park called Thousand Hills. It's the 12th place in the world to earn a special title, Urban Night Sky Place.
It feels great. It was a lot of work.
That's Ryan Persinger, the park superintendent. He and his coworkers are reducing light pollution by installing better fixtures and bulbs.
The point of this certification is not to just get rid of all of the lights, because we want lights on the ground so we're safe. We just don't want them pointing up so we can't see the sky, or pointing in our eyes so we can't see at all.
Persinger is referring to one of the most important concepts in the growing movement to bring back starry skies. A lot of the wattage that homeowners, businesses, and public agencies use outdoors doesn't actually help us see. For example, picture a lamppost with a glass globe on top. It shines a good chunk of its light into the sky. That portion never reaches the street and sidewalk. Instead, it just escapes upward. Another portion of the light shines out of the lamppost horizontally and ends up hitting people right in the eye and messing with their vision. That's called glare. Thousand Hills State Park is switching to fixtures that are designed to avoid the sky and your eyes, fixtures with shields that angle the light downward.
They also are the warm color, so more orange than that bright, obnoxious white-blue light.
Those amber bulbs are less disruptive to wildlife and to human sleep. At nearby Truman State University in Kirksville, similar changes are underway, led by faculty and students who have pulled together nearly $100,000 in grants for this. Daphne Broski-Lang helped with that. She graduated from the school last year.
When I would have some late nights working in the lab, I would go outside and it would be midnight or 1 a.m, and the birds would be chirping.
Birds were confused by all the light.
It was pretty unsettling, actually.
Plus, some of the outdoor lights were shining into dorms all night. As more lights get fixed on campus, it addresses problems like these. The retrofits keep the lights where it's needed, on the ground, and use amber LEDs, not white.
Overall, they look dimmer when you look at them. But we measured the brightness underneath the lights, and we found that on the ground, the illumination level was brighter.
Changes like this could also spell real energy savings if they become the norm. Dark Sky International, the advocacy group that certified Thousand Hills as an urban night sky place, estimates wasted outdoor light adds up to 21 million tons of carbon dioxide annually for the U.S. Vyojit Gokhale is an astronomy professor at Truman and a board member of Dark Skies Missouri chapter. For anyone who wants to improve their outdoor lights at home, he says,
the three steps are good fixture, low lumens, and then amber color, low temperature.
So for the fixture, get one with an opaque cover to angle the light downward. For lumens, that refers to a bulb's brightness. Don't go brighter than you need. Try using lower lumens on your porch, for example, and see what you think.
There is some subjectivity there, right? What you consider low or what I consider low may be different. And that's fine, right? You're doing it for your front porch, but be conscious about that.
Next, for color temperature, Gokhale says look for a Kelvin number on the bulb package, and lower is better.
About 2200, 2700 Kelvin lights, certainly below 3000 Kelvin, or just look at the color, and the more amber colored it is, the better off you are, generally speaking.
One last rule of thumb, he says, make sure outdoor lights have a purpose. Remove the ones that don't, or turn them off when they're not being used. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Celia Yopis-Jepson.
A Central Illinois pumpkin farm will be open this fall, welcoming visitors with a lot of activities. But John Ackerman with Ackerman Family Farms says the retail side of the business will then come to an end.
After this year, I don't think we're going to open our farm to the public anymore. A lot of different reasons actually led to the decision. One was the amount of hours we put into the business. You got to be honest, I'm not getting any younger. I tracked my hours a couple years ago, and I realized I'd put in 5 consecutive 100-hour work weeks, and my wife did pretty much the same. So that's definitely played into it. And our costs have gone up quite a bit. Our labor costs have gone up quite a bit and some other things. It's starting to cut into the bottom line. Also, we were always worried that what if one of us had a health problem? We couldn't do this without each other. So we want to go out on a high note while things are going well. And it seemed like this was the right time.
John Ackerman and his family have played host to thousands of people at their farm east of Borton over the past 26 years. They come to buy pumpkins and enjoy some seasonal fun, like a corn maze and hay rides.
We've been so blessed. People have just been just fantastic to us. We have the best demographics of customers. Gosh, we get animal lovers and nature lovers and families and grandparents. We get foodies and people who are advocates for farming or interested in farming and want to learn about it. So, we've been so blessed. It's been a really difficult decision to bring it to a close, but we feel like it's probably the right one. But gosh, we're going to miss the customers. We're going to miss the employees we've had. We've had over 400 young men and women who have worked for us over the last quarter century, like you say. And man, we've been their friends. We've been their mentors. We've watched them grow. We've been to weddings. Some of them have brought back their kids to the farm to visit. It's been surprisingly wonderful beyond what we probably expected when we first started doing this.
Ackerman says he plans to continue growing pumpkins and other crops in the years ahead. Ackerman Family Farms is open to visitors starting August 27th through Halloween. We have more to come on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The COVID-19 pandemic interrupted the lives of students when schools were shut down and events were canceled, including the social rite of passage, that is, high school prom. An event this summer in Sioux City, Iowa, gave graduates the prom night they missed 5 years ago. Sheila Brummer reports.
Zip my dress up, please.
Yeah, sure.
Don't forget to clasp it.
Daisy Fetcher prepares for a night out with her husband, Hunter.
Beautiful, as always.
They stand in their living room with a playpen in the corner and two dogs running around. The couple is dressed for the red carpet. A babysitter is lined up for their one-year-old son. They're ready for prom.
The opportunity to be able to see, like, a bunch of old friends that, like, I haven't seen since that day we left. It brings me joy.
It's a redo for Betcher and her classmates. The stay-at-home mom was a senior at West High School when the COVID-19 pandemic hit Iowa in March of 2020.
I remember walking away one day and just not going back, and it really hurt because I made some really great friendships.
5 years later, Betcher and other Sioux City seniors of 2020 finally had their time to shine. At the Hard Rock in Sioux City, dozens of people dance as a live band plays hits from across different eras. Some wear sequin gowns with their hair in curls or updos. A few are even in tuxes. Betcher fits right in her long black satin dress.
A lot of people were affected by COVID, and just knowing that they put the effort into this was just so sweet and kind.
The Sioux City Public Schools Foundation hosted this alumni gathering called Rewrite the Night to give former students the prom experience they missed when the world shut down.
We really want to welcome you home. I hope you guys are having a great time tonight.
Director of Development Karen Harrison was one of the organizers.
They all went through this together, so they all know what it was like. And to have this reunion for them, I would think it's going to probably bring up some good things now.
In the years since high school, people have moved on to start careers and families. But Emily Fahrenholz recalls the sadness she felt after missing out on such an important milestone. When the coronavirus closed in, she'd already gone shopping with her mom and picked out the perfect prom dress.
like a week later, we got the message, hey, it's closed for 2 weeks. And then eventually it was for the rest of the year. It was definitely heartbreaking.
Fahrenholz now teaches history at the middle school where she was once a student. And the East High graduate still sees the impact of COVID-19 shutdowns in her classroom.
They have some challenges either socially or academically, but they have grown a lot in the 5 years after COVID, which is awesome to see. But it definitely did take a toll on everyone, for sure.
Liberty Pacheco's path to adulthood wasn't smooth either. She turned 18 during the early stages of the pandemic.
Stuck at home and all you can do is sit by yourself. And for somebody like me that has severe depression and anxiety, like it takes a mental toll.
The former North High student hated virtual learning and after a few personal setbacks dropped out of college. Tonight, she admits to feeling some jitters.
It's a lot of like excitement and then also nervousness and then also that kind of like that curious, like who's going to show up? Like who am I going to see that I recognize, I remember? Like because I wasn't a very popular kid when I grew up. I had a boy haircut.
Pacheco is now the life of the party. In salon-styled hair and a red gown with a plunging neckline.
I'm happy that I came. I'm happy that I spent the money on this dress and spent my time on everything because it truly is worth it.
She shares laughter and cocktails with friends, including coworker Riley Barrett, who attended West High and then culinary school on the East Coast. Barrett says this prom redo is all about making things right.
Get to relive the things we never thought we were and be able to write new memories with the friends of ours that, you know, are still here.
And Barrett is savoring the second chance. With his face full of joy, he embraces his boyfriend and the two share an endearing kiss.
No matter how hard times get, no matter how bleak things look, you know, there's always a bright side, you know. You can always get through it and you can get to the next day.
For one evening, the class of 2020 reunites, replacing the disappointment of the past. In Sioux City, I'm Sheila Brummer, IPR News.
As the school year is getting underway once again, we listen back to a story from a few months ago about a problem in education. The percentage of Illinois students who are chronically absent, meaning they miss more than 10% of the school year, skyrocketed during the early pandemic. It's fallen a bit since, but rates are still far higher than pre-COVID. Peter Midland reports.
Sonia Navarro's asking students where they're supposed to be while walking down the hallway at Constance Lane Elementary School in Rockford. It's her job to make sure kids are getting to class. It's her first year as an attendance specialist. This year, for the first time, every Rockford school has one. So as much time as she spends with the kids, getting students to school means working with their parents and helping them understand how attendance affects their child's success.
When a child has such poor attendance, it makes it difficult to provide them the interventions and the resources here because of attendance.
Navarro calls it a snowball effect. Kids miss school, they fall behind on assignments, they get frustrated, they start acting out, and then they don't want to come to school. And it can be difficult to break that cycle, but she says helping students often starts with helping their parents. They've got a Google map that shows all the community resources in the area, like laundromats and food pantries. They can get some families gas cards, but for most parents, she says the biggest challenge is transportation.
They're working 2 to 3 jobs, and those hours between getting them on the bus or getting them to school, I mean, the job is the priority, which I as a parent can understand that.
So they've started a tutoring program before school, which provides transportation. So far, they've had over 100 students get involved, and they've connected families with after-school programs, which she says has helped a lot too. And of course, she also tries to motivate her students.
We could try to do, you know, a McDonald's if they like McDonald's.
It seems to be working. RPS Chief of Schools Morgan Gallagher says they've seen chronic absence rates fall significantly across the district, and particularly at elementary schools. It's a bit more complicated at the high school, where attendance can be less within a parent's control. Back in 2022, at its worst, about 60% of RPS students were chronically absent. They cut it down to 46% last year, but it's still persistently higher than pre-COVID levels. Gallagher says that impacts academic achievement too.
We're making the right gains, but chronic absenteeism is the ceiling.
You can only improve graduation rates or literacy levels so much if a large portion of the district is chronically not going to school. And this is not just a Rockford problem. At all kinds of districts, chronic absenteeism has settled from those highest COVID peaks to a new normal that's still much higher than before. Where Rockford has 27,000 students, the Stewart Elementary School District has 56. Nearly 20% of those students were chronically absent last year, where in 2018 it was under 2%. Now, either way, with a school that small, those changes represent just a few students, and their solutions are likely going to be much different than in a district like Rockford. Steven Simpson is the superintendent, and he feels like part of it is that families are just choosing to keep their kids at home longer when they're sick, but that's not all. As COVID-era upheaval caused stress and anxiety for many teachers and students, they adopted a social-emotional learning curriculum for the first time in the district's history.
We wanted to give faculty and our students a common language for talking about relational issues, conflict, conflict resolution.
He hopes it'll make school feel more welcoming, so students are less likely to avoid it. Steve Wilder is the superintendent at Sycamore, a middle-sized district between Stewart and Rockford, and he says they've committed to mental health support as well, and that the pandemic opened their eyes to the real anxiety many of their students face. Wilder says even though they're on the right track, chronic absenteeism is not a problem that's going to go away anytime soon.
My gut is that drop, that decline might take a little bit longer than we'd like to. You know, it might be much more gradual, but I don't know that we'll ever get back to the rates that we were at pre-COVID.
Back at Constance Lane, Navarro says they're taking more time to show families they can help and also connect with them in fun ways. She says they just held a family dance for Valentine's Day, complete with pizza and a DJ. And schools everywhere will keep trying to convey the importance of attendance and how if you're not in school, it makes it pretty hard to learn. I'm Peter Medlin.
Every fall, more than 1,500 first-year students start at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. About half of them are the first in their families to attend college. It's a big milestone for a group that faces challenges not only in applying to school, but in adjusting and making it to graduation. Lisa Currian Phillips spoke with one of those first-year students, Jayla Ward, as she was preparing to transition to college life this fall.
Jayla Ward and I meet in the backyard garden of her uncle's house in Lee, Illinois.
I guarantee you, anybody listening probably doesn't know where that is. I just want you to imagine cornfields. Down the street, I have a neighbor with cows, and I'm currently looking at windmills, so I hope that gives you like a good idea of where we're at.
Jayla is tall, lanky, and in very fashionable contrast to her surroundings, with tailored black pants and a matching black vest over a white turtleneck. Her reddish curls cascade around blingy, Saturn-shaped earrings. Jayla grew up in Chicago's western suburbs with her mom, who's a housekeeper. She came to Lee earlier this summer to stay with her uncle before she moves onto campus. Lee is a town over from DeKalb, where she'll be going to college to study marketing.
I wanted to find a job before all these people come to college and then steal the jobs. One thing about me, I don't like being broke. I've had a part-time job since the second I turned 16.
The move paid off. She got a job at Goodwill and has already started working there 25 to 30 hours a week. It's just one of many steps Jayla has taken to prepare herself and the people around her for her college journey, because no one in her family has done this before. And there are things the 18-year-old has had to think about that her classmates from wealthier, college-educated families don't, like juggling her new job with classes and studying, along with an unpaid marketing internship she scored with NIU's athletics department.
Truthfully, I really wish I could just quit my job and focus on this internship, but I have to support myself. I have all these big dreams and these big aspirations, but I just don't think I'm going to have the time for it all. I'm just going to try to do the most that I can.
It is, after all, the full college experience Jayla wanted. That's why she ultimately chose NIU.
It's the cheapest, and I get to live on campus. And they got a good business school. It works for me.
Jayla makes her college decision sound so easy breezy, but really, it was a process. She had to find a college that was both a good fit and affordable. And again, no one in her family could tell her, hey, you might really like it at X, Y, and Z college.
So that's also pretty nerve-wracking. They can't give me some words of wisdom because they haven't gone.
Instead, she had to rely on her gut and a college access organization called Green Halo Scholars. They help low-income students in the western suburbs get to and through college. But Jayla's gut and Green Halo were sometimes at odds with one another. Like when Jayla committed to DePaul University, mostly for its name. Green Halo's director said, "Are you sure? It's too expensive for you to live on campus."
I, like, freaked out last minute because I'm like, oh, my God, if I lose my scholarship, I would have to pay, like, $62K a year. That's, like, generational debt. I was seeing people, like, do their, like, buy their dorm stuff, and I'm just like, that should be me.
In the end, NIU's affordability and the chance to live on campus won out. She got a scholarship that will cover almost all of her expenses. Now, she's totally gung-ho about it. She's already bought an NIU shirt to wear on her first day. In fact, with just a few days left before move-in day, Jayla mostly seems worried about her mom.
She doesn't want the baby bird to go out of the nest because I'm her only child. It is just, it's been me and her all my life.
That's why Jayla's got one more to do before moving into her dorm next week.
I'm going to leave a bunch of sticky notes around the house with random messages. So that way for like the first couple of days, maybe weeks, depending how good I hide a couple of the sticky notes, she's just going to like open various things and then see little notes left by me.
So her mom can find reminders of Jayla and feel her close. Lisa, Corey, and Philip, WBEZ News.
Romeo and Juliet may not be the most obvious play to adapt for kids. It has R-rated scenes and death. But what if you turn the characters into animals and perform it in a zoo? That's what the St. Louis Shakespeare Festival has done with the help of a famous puppet designer. Jeremy Goodwin reports.
Night falls at the St. Louis Zoo, and out come the animals to put on a play. Even the cranky sea lions. That's the concept behind Romeo and Juliet. It translates Shakespeare's themes into something kids can relate to. The story details are different, but the emotions are similar. Take the famous balcony scene.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?
Playwright Jennifer Joan Thompson says the two star-crossed mammals, Juliet's a bear, Romeo's a prairie dog, they pledge not to love each other and marry, but to share their toys and be best friends.
That significance of those early relationships is as deep and as profound. And those kids have such massive, tragic emotions sometimes. It's fun to call on that.
Do you want to be best friends?
Yes!
Hubba, wait! Are you ready to be best friends forever?
I promise.
Oh, don't promise. Promises are just words.
Juliet? Prairie Dog Romeo is a 2-foot-tall hand puppet who walks on his hind legs, with the help of actor Jordan Moore. The Juliet puppet is a 5-foot-tall bear cub in a red Elizabethan-style dress. Actor Ricky Franklin straps into it with a harness and moves it around the stage.
And we can play and play and play! Come, gentle knight, give me my Romeo!
Okay, but what about Romeo and Juliet's whole everyone dies at the end issue? Director Tom Ridgely says there's a route to a powerful but less lethal climax when you make Juliet a bear.
That allows Juliet, instead of dying, to go into hibernation. So it's still sad. She still doesn't get to play with Romeo for a very, very, very long time. But it keeps all of the 8 characters alive at the end of the play.
The playwright, Thompson, adapted the story from a 2015 children's book. She knew that to make it work on stage, the team would need some great animal puppets. Enter Michael Curry. He earned fame by designing the life-size puppets in the Lion King musical. His team once made a 20-foot-tall lion for pop star Katy Perry to ride into her Super Bowl halftime show. The request to help take Shakespeare to the zoo made Curry purr.
I'm this animal, you know, I'm the Lion King. You know, I'm an animal expert. So you can imagine when somebody said, we're going to do it. Shakespeare with animal puppets, and the animals are 500 feet away. I just thought, this is the greatest idea ever.
Retract thy claws.
On a recent humid evening, actor Ryan Omar Stack stands on a newly built stage in St. Louis Zoo near the sea lion habitat. He holds a 4-foot-tall sea lion puppet, moving it fluidly around the stage with both hands. As the Prince of Zurona, he reprimands feuding members of rival families.
3 civil brawls between you carnivores and herbivores have thrice disturbed the quiet of our zoo. Remind your lords that they are keystone species whose loss could well undo an ecosystem.
So yeah, the play sneaks in lots of zoological education, too. Director Ridgely says the show still gets Shakespeare's point across.
Guess what? Hating people is still a bad idea. We can't stop teaching that.
And if a grizzly bear and a prairie dog can put aside their differences, perhaps there's hope for some of the other species inhabiting the planet. Wherefore art thou, Jeremy Goodwin, in St. Louis?
More to come on Statewide. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. An iconic piece of art in downtown Galesburg has migrated to a new home. Jane Carlson brings us the story.
Mother Goose's wings are dramatically outstretched, and she wears a pointed bonnet tied at the neck. Two children are nestled in front of those unfurled wings, clutching and staring intently at an oversized book. And every bit of this whimsical scene is rendered in steel.
This sculpture was done by my dad, Rick Larson, quite a long time ago.
That's Zach Larson. He's a software engineer in the Quad Cities, but he grew up in the Galesburg area. As a kid, Zach would tag along with Rick to art fairs all over the Midwest.
Whenever those fairs would happen, my dad would spend Friday, get the van packed up. He had a whole display set up that he made, tent for his booth and everything, all the inventory. He'd have it ready to go. I'd get home on the school bus, immediately just hop in the van, and we'd hit the road.
Zach says his dad started off as a woodworker, carving birds and other wildlife. Then Rick started working with resin, and eventually with welded steel.
The work started small, and over the years got bigger and bigger. So, I mean, that was the other thing. Outside the art shows, he'd get commission work around the country, and we'd travel, and I'd go with him and go install it and see these people's amazing houses that they were having his stuff in, which I thought was awesome.
Zach says those days with his dad on the road are some of the most fun times of his life. He grew up understanding that his dad's job was different from what other kids' dads did for a living.
I always tell my wife, I could always tell how good the art show went by what kind of pizza we'd have. So it was either Domino's if the show didn't go very well, or it'd be something really good. So
Rick was born in Galesburg. Zach says one of his dad's mentors was beloved Galesburg High School art teacher and sculptor Jimmy Crown, who inspired generations of local artists.
He was a big influence on my dad. So when I was a kid, I always remember my dad pointing at sculptures around Galesburg, and there's one specifically at the high school. And he would always tell me, you know, I worked on that with Jimmy Crown.
Zach was in college when his dad was commissioned to create the Mother Goose sculpture for the Galesburg Public Library, which was then on Simmons Street. Zach says it was a huge honor for his dad to be asked to do that.
His stuff is installed all around the Midwest and other parts of the country. And this was the first big one that I can remember that was local, and his name was on it. And I think he was very proud of that just because it was local.
The Mother Goose sculpture was commissioned in 2003. Zach remembers coming home from college and seeing the sculpture in various stages of construction in his dad's garage. It was installed in the storybook garden on the east side of the old library, a beacon of creativity on the corner of Cherry and Simmons Streets, for more than two decades. The artist Rick Larson died in 2014. Now it's Zach who drives his kids around Galesburg to share the meaning of a sculpture.
I mean, he passed away when my daughter was one, my son was four. So this is where we stop and see.
That library on Simmons Street was meant to be a temporary location after Galesburg's Carnegie Library burned in 1958. After six decades in that temporary location, a dream for Galesburg came true. Its new $20 million public library opened on Main Street last year. When Zach and his brother Jake first heard about construction beginning for a new library, they had one thought.
Oh no, where's the sculpture going to go? So I reached out to the library and I said, you know, my brother and I, our dad made this sculpture. We'd just like to know what the plan is for it. I mean, if you have a plan for it, if you don't, I'll make a plan for it.
The library said they did plan to take Mother Goose to the new location. But first, Zach had plans to spiff her up. Mother Goose had rusted a bit at the old library. She had lichens growing all over her, and wasps had moved into that oversized book the children hold in the sculpture. So with the permission of the library, Zach decided to take Mother Goose on a little road trip late last year. He drove to Galesburg, backed his car up on the sidewalk, and he cut Mother Goose loose.
And I had a hacksaw and some various tools, and I managed to get it ripped off the base. I threw it in my car and took it back to the Quad Cities, and I found a local guy up there to do this. He sandblasted it and got it all cleaned up for me. I put a clear coat on it, which was kind of funny because I remember my dad doing the same thing, you know, however long ago that was.
Gelsberg's Lackey Monuments installed a new base for Mother Goose at the new library. She now greets visitors from a perch not far from the entrance. Seeing the sculpture for the first time on that new base in the new location, Zach sees more than Mother Goose, the two children, and the oversized book. He sees the artist.
I see his style. I mean, he was influenced by Jimmy Crown, Giacometti, the sculptor. I'm reminded of all the pieces that he made over the years.
And the plaque that hung on the old base also came with Mother Goose to the new library.
The inscription says Mother Goose by Rick Larson in celebration of imagination, giving flight to the written and spoken word. Friends of the Library, 2003.
Zach says his father would be proud of where Mother Goose sits now. I'm Jane Carlson.
The town of Macomb, like many others, just purchased new squad cars. And that led reporter Rich Egger to wonder how the vehicles have changed through the years.
Like with so many other things, the technology for squad cars has advanced by leaps and bounds.
The technology in here allows officers to do so much more than we were 25 years ago.
Chief Jeff Hamer joined the department in 2001. He says back then, dashboard cameras were new, and they were big and bulky. They even blocked a bit of an officer's view looking through the windshield.
Now what we have are HD cameras. They're much smaller. In fact, the one in here is smaller than a smartphone, about half the size. And then the hard drive is all the way wired into the trunk. So none of that equipment is kind of blocking your view.
While dashboard cameras were new in 2001, the use of body cameras was still a few years off. Now those cameras are synchronized through Bluetooth.
So when we activate our emergency lights to pull over a car, not only does it turn on the dashboard camera, but it also turns on our body camera. So that's less buttons for the officer to press or forget to press. And so it kind of makes a more consistent recording environment.
Hamer says that also helps the officer focus on the vehicle they're pulling over and the people in it instead of thinking about activating their body cam. The chief says officers today use military-grade laptops in the field with faster speeds and better processing than equipment at the turn of the century. Officers can easily take them out of the car and carry them right to a crime scene to take notes, photos, and video. In addition, squad cars now have articulated mounts for the laptops, allowing them to be adjusted according to each officer's height and preference. Changes in squad cars extend beyond the driver area. Hamer says the back seats of squad cars are designed differently now, too.
Now what we have is a kind of a crafted prisoner compartment that's made specifically for prisoner transport.
Hamer says some of the vehicles have seat belts that belt to the door side of the rear cabin. This means officers don't have to reach across a person's face or chest to get them buckled in, and that helps them avoid possible hazards presented by someone being arrested.
Especially if they were a little bit combative or if they had airborne illnesses and things like that. We were thinking of safety on all fronts.
And instead of heavy gauge metal, a plexiglass shield separates the front of the car from the back. The vehicles look different from the outside, too. In the late 90s, Macomb police drove the streets in white four-door sedans with blue lettering. Now they drive black and white SUVs with black and gold lettering.
So SUVs sit higher up in traffic. We're able to see more. SUVs are popular. The prices come down on them over time. So not only can we see more, but it also holds the equipment a little bit better and a little more room for the officers and anybody else riding in the vehicle.
Hamer says SUVs are the vehicle of choice for most police departments, though some rural departments opt for pickup trucks. The Macomb department has 10 marked squad cars and another half dozen cars that are unmarked or for other uses, such as for DARE officers. They rotate out two cars every year. Each car costs about $55,000 to buy and equip. Hamer says equipment such as cameras and laptops can get reused. The chief says today's squad cars handle better and include more safety features than when he joined the department. And he says with advancements in technology, the equipment is smaller, more rugged, and longer lasting. Rich Egger reporting.
4 times a year, Illinois public radio stations air a special statewide show called Prison Cast that serves people in Illinois prisons and jails. The show receives hundreds of messages from incarcerated people, many saying they're working to better themselves while they do time. But there are barriers to doing that, some of which are only skin deep. Prison Cast producer Lauren Frost takes us to the town of Canton for a report on how tattoo removal programs could help people in custody start fresh.
Like lots of stories I report on, this one starts with a letter I got from inside prison.
Dear Prison Cast, the reason for me writing and reaching out was I was trying to get a bill started in my name that will benefit every incarcerated man and woman that's faced with the same problem I'm dealing with.
This is Adonis Veal. He's incarcerated at Illinois River Correctional Center, a prison in central Illinois. And that problem he's dealing with, his face is covered in tattoos.
I think my teardrops was my first tattoo.
Some gang-related stuff.
Then I got the 6G.
One is a hate symbol, though he says that's not why he got it. Adonis says ever since he began serving his sentence, he's wanted to take them all off.
I want to change my circle, my crowd, and I just wanted to change my appearance because it's like I don't want to be 60, 70 years old with tattoos in my face.
But here's the issue. He has no way to remove them or cover them while he's in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections.
I think that if guys could take advantage of that opportunity, they would.
That's where his idea comes in. For a state law to establish a tattoo removal program for incarcerated people. We wanted to investigate whether that's been done before and what it might look like. And it turns out, it's not such a wild idea. Last spring, I paid a visit to Redemption Studio. It's a state-licensed tattoo parlor, and it's inside the DuPage County Jail in Wheaton, Illinois.
This is a fully functional tattoo studio. We got everything we need here.
This is Nick Perry, an artist with Empire Tattoos. When I visit, he's working with a client named Matthew, who's been getting some gang tattoos removed and covered.
At first, it's kind of difficult because you've had them for a long time. They become a part of you.
But Matthew says his mind changed as he got older. He's got 3 grandkids now.
And if you take a realistic look at your life, it's a decision doesn't only affect me. It affects my family. I've been out in public with my mother and ran into some trouble because of my tattoos. So as I got older, it's a lot easier to make the decision.
The artists and technicians who visit Redemption Studio don't just hide gang tattoos or hate symbols. They'll cover branding marks from human trafficking, scars from bullet wounds or self-harm. Anything that might make it hard for someone to move forward. Another client, Nicholas, says his old ink represents his old identity. He thinks he got his first tattoos when he was 13 or 14 years old.
I knew that if I was going to transition into this new life that I had pictured for myself, I knew that things have to be removed. And you have to kill that old identity that you had, you know, shaped for yourself.
This is just one program at one county-run jail. The Illinois Department of Public Health says it's not aware of any other body art studios in the state that are inside prisons or jails. But traveling studios are another option. California's Department of Corrections launched a statewide tattoo removal program in 2023. Associate Warden Melanie Bruns says they work with a contractor who drives mobile studios to all the different state prisons there.
I would highly encourage other Department of Corrections to consider this. The feedback that we've gotten from our population has been nothing but positive. I mean, we have wait lists at almost all of our institutions.
The Illinois Department of Corrections denied our request for an interview about whether it's considered a tattoo removal program here and did not respond to written questions by our deadline. Back at Illinois River Prison, Adonis hopes legislators will consider his pitch for what he's calling the Adonis L. Veal Tattoo Removal Act. In the meantime, he's finding other ways to reinvent himself, despite the dehumanizing conditions of a state prison.
I'm like 60% better than what I was coming in. I think the other 40% will be when I hit the gate and practice everything that I learned behind these prison walls.
Adonis says he's educating himself, working, reading, and trying to make the most of his time. I'm Lauren Frost.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations. We'll be right back.